countries like China in particular should be worried with how Mr. Trump approaches sort of international relations when he just does things that he wants and doesn't really listen to those around him.
Asia closely watches Trump-Putin summit. It's Tuesday, July 17th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Join us if you can. Also ahead, U.S. and North Korean officials begin to meet, taking a bite out of mosquitoes, shooting hoops at the monastery, naturally feeding newborns, and brides roll their way to wedding day. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Donald Trump, standing alongside Russian President Vladimir Putin, has declared he cannot see any reason to believe Moscow meddled in the election that led him to becoming U.S. president in 2016. Every major U.S. intelligence agency has concluded there was such interference by Russia during that election, and the matter is the focus of a major federal investigation that has targeted not only Russians, but members of Trump's election campaign staff. The U.S. president said he did not directly criticize his Russian counterpart over that issue or any of which Washington and Moscow have significant differences. American politicians on both sides of the aisle, as well as former U.S. intelligence officials and diplomats, began sharply criticizing Trump's remarks even before the president had boarded Air Force One for the flight back home. One nation that most likely was watching the outcome of the Trump-Putin meeting was China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about that interest with John Ferguson, director of global forecasting at the analytical firm Economist Intelligence Unit in London.
I think when we think about how China would view today's events, and today's events were quite extraordinary, I think China will see both a bit of an opportunity but also a bit of a risk with what happened today. So maybe we can start with the risks. For us at the EIU, it's been the biggest risk to the global economy since the start of the year. Absolutely, it's the biggest risk to the global economy. And China is right in the middle of it with Mr. Trump disputing over China's technology transfer practices and practices around intellectual property. So what I think China would have been wary with today is they would have seen that Mr. Trump just does things that he wants to do. With Mr. Putin in Russia, Mr. Trump would have had a lot of people telling him to address concerns around Russian interference in the 2016 election and so on. But Mr. Trump plays things his own way, and he's happy to ignore a large range of people who want him to do something. Now, we think he'll feel a lot of pressure on the trade war with China, basically pressure to pull back from the trade war with China. But as we saw today in Helsinki, he'll do things his own way. And I think, and we think that, you know, countries like China in particular should be worried with how Mr. Trump approaches sort of international relations when he just does things that he wants and doesn't really listen to those around him.
Do you expect to see China make any particular movements or alterations to the way it has tried to handle this so far?
I think China's in a very, very difficult situation trying to work out how to deal with Mr. Trump, especially on trade. They would have been watching today's events in Helsinki, trying to see if there was anything they can learn from how Mr. Putin has worked with Mr. Trump. I don't think they would have learned too much there today. But, you know, I think China will continue to take a bit of a carrot and stick approach to Mr. Trump and trade.
Are there any other countries throughout Asia that this might have had an effect upon?
Yeah, there's a couple of areas. I mean, to be honest, I think there's a few countries out in Asia that will be quite worried about how Mr. Trump is conducting himself. Mr. Trump, I mean, we in the policy community and the sort of analysis community, we talk of something named the international order. Now, this is the order the U.S. has built since the end of the Second World War. The IMF, the WTO, NATO, and so on. Mr. Trump, for better or worse, he is upending that geopolitical global order. So if you're a country like Japan, an ally of the US, I think you are very worried. You know, Mr. Trump has shown that on the trade issue, it doesn't matter if you're an ally or not. He's applied steel and aluminium tariffs, and right now he is involved in a dispute with the EU. He's called the EU a foe, and he's applying these tariffs to the EU. So you're a country like South Korea or Japan out there in Asia, I think you are very worried with Mr. Trump's approach to trade into allies. Because what we've seen from Mr. Trump is that the traditional sort of alliance system that the U.S. has built over decades, it looks like, and he's signaled this many times, that he doesn't take those alliances very seriously. He doesn't care about them very much at all. So if you're Japan or South Korea, I think you are worried that America first, well, as a mantra, as a motto, it doesn't leave much for countries like Japan and South Korea. So there are countries there that should be worried about Mr. Trump's approach to the world.
John Ferguson, Director of Global Forecasting at the analytical firm Economist Intelligence Unit, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find currently trending on voanews.com. Surge in South China Sea naval exercises in 2018 vexes Beijing. China suffers setback in its EU trade rapprochement. Jailed Reuters reporter pleads innocence in Myanmar court. Largest U.S. port complex braces for extended U.S.-China trade war. Saving a critically endangered Aboriginal language in Australia. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The U.S. and North Korea military officials are meeting at the inter-Korean border truce village of Panmunjom to work out details on the repatriation of the remains of American service personnel killed during the Korean War. It is the first such meeting in 9 years and is one of the commitments reached during the U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore last month between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Joshua Pollack, a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, speaks with VOA's Victor Beatty.
By pursuing it, it makes good on a North Korean commitment, and it also demonstrates, perhaps more subtly, that the two sides have an understanding that the 4 points are not to be addressed in that order only, but can be addressed simultaneously. This is important because the first point is the improvement of relations. The second point is a peace regime. And the third point is denuclearization. So, for example, when Kim Jong-un wrote a letter to President Trump, which President Trump tweeted out, it only referred to improvement of relations. It didn't refer to any of the other 4 points. And the suspicion of some readers was that Kim was, in effect, making a demand for progress on that point before anything else could happen. So seeing progress on the fourth point is a neat way of demonstrating that progress is possible on all of them at once, including on denuclearization.
There are thousands of remains, potentially, of military personnel. This obviously is important to the U.S., specifically to the families of those who were killed.
And this has happened before, when there have been periods of relative calm and cooperation between the United States and North Korea. I believe from 1996 through 2005, there were also joint searches for war remains in North Korean territory involving U.S. Army personnel in the searches. That came to an end when relations went into a particularly deep down spiral. It really was the last thing to survive the end of the agreed framework in 2002.
Of course, Pompeo's trip earlier this month to Pyongyang made headlines because after he left, the North accused his delegation of making gangster-like demands in connection with denuclearization. What do you take from that?
I think that the disagreement between the Americans and North Koreans over Secretary Pompeo's last trip had to do with this question of sequencing the implementation of the Singapore agreement. The Americans seem to have come in to want to talk about getting a timetable set on denuclearization or some kind of understanding, some kind of plan of action. Whereas if you look at the North Korean statement, it echoed some of their statements of late May when it looked like the summit was coming off the rails. It emphasized that North Korea would not engage in unilateral disarmament and could not be compelled to do America's bidding, but had its own agenda. It emphasized steps on improving relations and achieving a peace regime, although it did nod to the denuclearization agenda by mentioning potential plans to demolish a missile testing site. What it conveyed on the whole was a fairly serious disagreement on, I think, the sequencing and the pace of implementing this agreement.
Joshua Pollack described the North Korean commitments made in Singapore as cautious, and the U.S. is learning all over again that such diplomatic efforts with North Korea are time-consuming, difficult, and frustrating, and prone not to yield instant results. To think otherwise, he said, is unrealistic. Happening now in Asia, China's economic growth slowed in the quarter ending in June, adding to the challenges for Beijing amid a mounting tariff battle with Washington. The Chinese economy grew at an expected 6.7% in the second quarter, its slowest pace since 2016. Investment growth and industrial output also slowed. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us, as always, on VOA Asia. More than 80% of the mosquitoes that spread dengue fever have been wiped out in a town in Australia during a pioneering tropical trial. It's a story we first reported yesterday, and today from Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more about the results, which scientists say could help global efforts to eradicate the dangerous pest.
Mosquitoes are one of the deadliest creatures on Earth. In northern Australia, millions of male Aedes aegypti or yellow fever mosquitoes were bred in a laboratory and infected with a naturally occurring bacteria that made them sterile. They were then released into the wild near the small farming town of Innisfail in Queensland, 1,600 kilometres north of Brisbane. Over 3 months, they mated with females, who laid eggs that didn't hatch, causing the population to fall sharply by about 80%. The type of mosquito used in the trial is responsible for infecting hundreds of millions of people around the world with diseases such as dengue, Zika, and yellow fever. The project was run by researchers from Australia's national science body, CSIRO, in a trial that received funding from Google's parent company, Alphabet. Dr. Rob Grenfell, the Director of Health and Biosecurity at the CSIRO, says the results are a major breakthrough.
Now, this is momentous in the sense that we've achieved a significant decrease in populations of mosquitoes in our test area here in northern Queensland, but also to commemorate the incredible community that actually backed our science here. Not only did they open their hearts and minds, but also their homes to allow our scientists to come in and trap and test our mosquito controlling technologies.
Australian researchers want to test the technology overseas in an area with high levels of dengue. They believe it could be a valuable weapon against a huge public health menace. The World Health Organization estimates that almost 4 billion people in 128 countries are at risk of contracting dengue. The disease is transmitted through the bite of an infected female mosquito. The WHO says that the global incidence of dengue has increased 30 times in the last 30 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, Tibetan monks pray their shots drop. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Japan is facing a major risk of reconstructing areas damaged during the recent torrential rains, which left nearly 10,000 households in three major cities completely shattered. The heat wave has compounded the misery and is responsible for at least 8 more deaths. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for the latest updates. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the game of basketball is finding fans in an unlikely place. Among young Tibetan Buddhist monks in the northern state of Himachal Pradesh, where many monasteries are nestled among verdant Himalayan slopes, Anjana Pasricha reports several monasteries have changed centuries-old traditions and allowed monks to play sports.
After a morning spent in prayer and study at the Palpung Sherabling Monastery in the mountains of Himachal Pradesh, it is time for an invigorating game of basketball for these young Tibetan Buddhist monks. 15-year-old Setin Bhutia loves the game.
Without playing, there's no fun.
The monastery's principal, Kempo Pema Negi, explains why some monasteries have relaxed old traditions and built courts.
Doctors in ancient Indian texts say it's very important to play games. Then the earlier rules were changed and games are openly allowed. Now they play without fear. Games relax the children's minds and make them sharper.
Shedub Wangdi says sport must go hand in hand with studies.
It is like yoga. I won't become fat if I jump well.
At the basketball court in Bir Diru Sakya, another monastery in the vicinity, the game keeps young monks happily engaged. 12-year-old Funga Namgyal loves the sport.
I'll become taller and more flexible.
But that is not all.
I'm really happy when I score a goal.
For this 10-year-old, the game is simply fun.
When the bigger men have the ball, I like to snatch it.
Jigme Thinle, who teaches Buddhist philosophy at this monastery, enjoys coaching the young monks in the game, which has become his favorite since he learned it in college.
The child monks who are the whole day in class, this gives them some activity and mental happiness. In class too, when it is about to be 5 o'clock, they must be thinking of basketball.
Sports have come to stay because monks now believe they contribute to the goal of a calm mind and happy life.
If your body is healthy, your mind is healthy. And if that happens, then your life is healthy.
On the courts, some monks score a goal, some miss. Some prefer just sitting with a book or watching. And as prayer flags flutter, the game acquires a gentler aura on these Himalayan slopes. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Himachal Pradesh.
This news from VOA Asia, the trial of an Australian filmmaker charged with endangering Cambodian national security for flying a drone over a campaign rally last year, has been postponed for a second time. Could receive 5 to 10 years in prison if convicted. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, world health officials were stunned when the United States opposed a resolution for countries to encourage breastfeeding, especially when decades of research have shown its benefits for both mothers and babies. VOA's Carol Pearson spoke with two prominent doctors who fully support the UN resolution based on scientific studies and explain the benefits and risks of breast or bottle feeding.
Millions of babies around the world would thrive if they received mother's milk for the first 6 months of life or longer. The findings come from the largest and most detailed study yet on the benefits of breastfeeding. It was published in the Lancet Medical Journal 2 years ago. The study showed breastfeeding could save the lives of 800,000 babies per year. Pediatricians say while women should have options, science is clearly on the side of breastfeeding.
The science of breastfeeding has been established for several decades.
Breastfeeding improves nutrition, decreases infections, and is cheaper than formula.
We know that right after birth, when the mother puts the baby to breast, the baby gets the colostrum, the early milk that the mother produces, and it's very high in immunoglobulins that protect the baby from infection. And then continued exclusive breastfeeding continues to support those health benefits for the baby.
For women to use infant formula, clean water is a must, not just for the formula, but also to clean the bottles. The nipples and spoons used to measure the formula must also be clean. If not, the baby can get diarrhea, which can be fatal. And because formula is expensive, if a mother tries to stretch it out, the baby will not get enough to eat.
The benefits of breastfeeding are extraordinarily high to be able to protect against these illnesses.
Breastfeeding also has clear benefits for the mother as well. For one, it reduces the chances that she will hemorrhage after giving birth. Doctors say women need to be supported by their physicians, by their families, by their communities, and by their employers in order to breastfeed their babies successfully, to give newborns the best chance at healthy lives. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Intricate design, white flowers, and see-through veils. A happy bride proudly wears her perfect wedding attire. It's white and made from toilet paper. June is a popular month for weddings, so the 14th annual Toilet Paper Wedding Dress Contest took place recently in New York. And as Elena Wolf reports, the entries shock the jury with the elegance and chic that one doesn't usually expect from hundreds of rolls of bath tissue. Anna Rice narrates her report.
Only the sound of rustling paper reveals the uniqueness of this wedding dress contest as finalists proudly show off their somewhat fragile gowns.
This dress is worth 250 hours of hard work and 32 rolls of toilet paper and 23 rolls of scotch tape and lots of glue and a very loving, helpful husband who cooked while I was busy gluing.
Susan Nicholson is from Georgia. Next year, her daughter Bianca is getting married and she knows far too well how much wedding dresses can cost. And although Bianca decided against sporting a paper gown on her own big day, she's helping her mom put together some paper jewelry for the contest.
The necklace is the same thing. It's with the toilet paper too. I love it. It's beautiful.
The jury takes the contest seriously, and the standards are very high. Out of the 1,500 submitted entries, only 10 dressmakers made it to the finals. But their creations are truly amazing, especially considering that they were allowed to use only toilet paper, glue, scissors, duct tape, and thread. The idea of a contest featuring disposable, chic, but definitely not easy to produce wedding dresses first occurred to founders of the wedding website Cheap Chic Weddings 14 years ago.
I gotta tell you, from a distance, you can't tell if it's the real thing or what. I mean, the product itself is so good that as we looked at many of the dresses and seeing unique uses of it, it's just amazing what many of these designers are able to create.
Corsets, lace, hats, and veils. Toilet paper masterfully used at the contest never looked so good. Contest winner Roy Cruz says he spent hours and hours on this veil.
In one square, I spent like 1 hour and 30 minutes every night. So my sister told me, oh my God, do you think you're going to finish that? Oh, I'm going to do this.
And the winner is Ronaldo Cruz.
But all his hard work paid off. The contest winner gets $10,000. So Roy, who last year lost his job as a florist, can now fly to the Philippines and spend some quality time with his family. Still, today's finalists are not destined to be worn. Since the contest started, only one dress ended up at a real wedding. The bride just made sure the weather on her big day was nice and sunny. Anna Rice for Elena Wolf, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Of the many ways you can hear our program, you can find us on the radio throughout Asia, like U Radio of Hatay University, FM 101.25, Hatay University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. We appreciate you joining us. We also appreciate having our director, Tracy Carter, in our control room, along with engineer Zineb Abdel-Rahman. Managing editor Diane Gao helps us put the program together, along with our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.